So much Monsanto herbicide was applied to so many Monsanto genetically engineered crops, weeds became resistant. Dow Chemical's solution to the resistance of these super weeds is to re-engineer corn so it will resist the herbicide 2,4-D. As 2,4-D was a major constituent of Agent Orange, many have come to call Dow's new product Agent Orange Corn. This Agent Orange Corn leads us to ask, is agriculture science outsmarting itself by creating super weeds and super problems?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 774th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Olongapo City who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at MetroFarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with Engineer Ricochet on the boards. Hello, Rick.
Good day, Michael.
Folks, it's pure magic. Think about it for a moment. Driving through America's heartland, what do you see? Acre upon acre, section after section, mile after mile of picture-perfect crops. But what you will not see are any weeds, nor any hoe-wielding farm workers. Now, as every gardener knows, weeds are the enemy. They steal sunshine, water, nutrients. Left alone, weeds will steal the entire garden and leave one with nothing left to eat. So when you see mile after mile of picture-perfect crops with not a hoe-wielding farm worker in sight, you know there is magic afoot. That magic is technology that allows us to re-engineer plants so they become resistant to chemicals. This resistance allows farmers to sit back in their air-conditioned satellite-guided tractors and apply herbicides that kill all the weeds in the field. Now, this technology was first placed on the table some years ago by the Monsanto Corporation, and whose Roundup Ready herbicide and genetically engineered Roundup Ready crops have made the company billions. Some now say, however, that Monsanto became a victim of its own success, and so much Monsanto herbicide was applied on so many Monsanto crops that weeds around the world became Monsanto-resistant superweeds. To help farmers and hopefully earn a few billion dollars for itself, Dow Chemical is offering a solution Agent Orange resistant corn, because the corn will become resistant, which was one of the two prime constituents of 2,4-D, which is one of the two prime constituents of Agent Orange that was made popular in the Vietnam War. Many fear that what may happen when farmers begin covering their croplands with 2,4-D, what the heck could happen? And so today we ask, is agriculture science outsmarting itself by creating super weeds and super problems? Here to help us find some answers, we have two people from an organization called Save Our Crops. First, we'll start with attorney Gene Sealer. Gene, welcome to the Food Chain.
Good morning.
A pleasure to have you aboard. What is Save Our Crops?
Well, Save Our Crops is a coalition that has joined together to address the risk of volatilization or off-target drift from the application of 2,4-D. But what the mission of Save Our Crops is probably best addressed by Steve Smith or someone else. I participate in that group, but mostly because I'm legal counsel for farmers or
okay. Well, Steve's coming up next, so we'll pick him up on that question. But you were a farm girl, right? You grew up on a farm?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Let me ask you the big question. Did you hoe any weeds?
Oh, many, many, I can assure you.
So I, too, was a teenage herbicide. So the question is, I'd like to ask you, do you know of any farmers who don't like this technology of engineering, re-engineering crops so that they become resistant to herbicides, so people like you and I don't have to go out in the fields and weeds? Do you know of any farmers who don't like that technology?
Well, I guess, first of all, I think the real issue is about off-target drift as far as we're concerned. And I would never describe it the way you are.
I think
that's a kind of an oversimplification, and maybe, and I'm not picking with you. I mean, I understand. I just think that's not a reality. I think herbicides have been applied to weeds since probably
a long time ago. Yeah.
So I don't think farmers' primary means of addressing weeds was hoeing forever. My dad had five daughters, so maybe he had an overabundance and we did a little extra cleanup. But by no means was I suggesting that the primary means of weed control in our farm had any, was hoeing.
Right, right. And, well, it really is kind of magic, isn't it, that we don't have to go out and weed, you know, and you can drive through the heartland of America and see all of these crops, you know, and essentially you don't see any farmers out there with hoes, you know, cutting weeds. It's really an amazing thing, and it is made possible by the magic of chemicals and chemical resistant crops. And but your experience with Drift, you became an attorney, you grew up and went to law school and became an attorney, and now you're working on the issue of Drift. What is Drift?
Well, primarily Drift means that an herbicide that's intended to be applied by a farmer to his individual field because of means of application or weather or other situation ends up landing off target. And as a result of being off target, the other vegetation affected is negatively affected. I mean, you wanted to kill the weeds, but unfortunately, if you're not pointed at the weeds, you're going to kill other broadleaf, you know, vegetation, whether it's in someone's yard or a neighboring tomato crop or, you know, what have you. I mean, any broadleaf plant is going to be affected just like a broadleaf weed would be. And so that's where the problem of spray drift comes in. And most states have regulations and training and certifications that applicators are required to take and required to comply with, but that doesn't prevent the incidents from occurring.
Good. And then that's when you step in as an attorney, right?
Right. Typically someone would call me and say, you know, someone has sprayed and the flowers in my greenhouse are devastated, or my strawberry plants or the tomato crop or what have you. And, you know, we need to address this.
Okay.
Typically they've already done some work in terms of identifying the problem, you know, calling out the Department of Agriculture Pesticide Division, and, you know, having some testing on plant tissue done.
And then the 2,4-D is a pesticide that has been around for a long, long time. It was one of the prime constituents of Agent Orange, which was made famous during the Vietnam War. But it wasn't the real toxic one, the one with the dioxin. It was the less toxic one. And so it's still in use, very much in use throughout the United States and around the world. But it does have a interesting effect with respect to drift, which we hope to pick up down the line a little bit as we go now to Steve Smith, who is a food processor. Correct, Steve?
That's correct, yes.
And you're processing tomatoes?
Yeah, we are a tomato processor located in Indiana and have production in Indiana, Ohio, and Michigan. And our company, along with many others, has foreseen some of these issues that Gene was describing and have come together to join Save Our Crops.
And how many people are in Save Our Crops anyway?
Well, it's really hard to get a good handle because many of our members are associations that might have 200 members or they might have 2,000 members, and so we've never really quantified a total number.
And exactly what are you trying to save your crops from?
Save Our Crops is very narrowly focused in basically just a single-issue coalition that is concerned about the off-target movement of particularly 2,4-D and the upcoming release of dicamba-tolerant crops in the same form as what the 2,4-D corn that you're describing.
Mm-hmm. So essentially, we're developing crops that are resistant to herbicides so that farmers can spray their fields with these crops, kill the weeds, not have to deal with the weeds, have a perfect field with no gene sealers out there hoeing weeds, right?
Exactly.
Okay, and then with respect to your experience, what happens when there is drift, Steve, as a processing tomato guy?
Well, the initial effects is that we lose some of our production, and so that has negative connotations for both us as a processor in supplying our customers the required volume of canned product that they're looking for. Our growers then lose their farm income. And, it doesn't take much of an imagination to know that that's a pretty negative situation for an individual family farmer.
So then what is really good for one farmer can be really bad for the farmer next door when the herbicide drifts from one place to the next, and then somebody is going to have to pay the consequences. Folks, we're talking drift happens, I guess, here on the Food Chain today, and we're talking about the development of crops that are resistant to herbicides and the miracle of that for farmers and the problem that it may create for everybody else. We will be right back on the Food Chain. Please do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain radio program. Michael Olson, your host for the day. Today we're talking with attorney Gene Sealer, crop processor Steve Smith, both of an organization called Save Our Crops. And we are trying to save the crops. Gene's going to have to leave us here in a little while. And since she is the expert on drift litigation, I'd like to pick up, go down the row a little bit here to a question I have listed later, but should pick up now. And that is, what happens? What are some of the things we're really worried about with this technology? And one of them is this something called volatilization. I think I pronounced it right, but maybe not, that we didn't necessarily experience when we were dealing with Monsanto's Roundup Ready glyphosate. So, Jean, could you kind of tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I think the reason Save Our Crops was really organized is because there have been a lot of issues surrounding Roundup Ready crops when they're grown next to crops, and I'll use as an example tomato crops, which are affected substantially by drift. And so there was this recognized problem that was being addressed as best as we could through the court system. And along came 2,4-D-resistant engineered crops or dicamba-resistant crops, and they create an even more difficult issue insofar as, you know, addressing how are we going to track this down and who's going to be responsible, and that's this volatilization issue. Because with those sprays being applied, they can simply kind of lift up or volatilize, and I'll simplify it by saying almost like a cloud, and move a matter of mile or miles and then come down on another field. And so at that point, you'll see evidence of the crop being decimated or damaged. But the question is, where did this come from? Which of the cornfields? And we lose things like drift pattern and being able to trace back to what day did someone apply when there was a high wind blowing towards the tomato field, where historically with drift, we had some opportunity to show the cause and to track the cause and then to have the farmers or the processors be compensated. So it was the realization that this new element of volatilization would make showing cause and tracking to cause, I won't say an impossibility, but very, very difficult, if not an impossibility, that caused people to really organize and say, hey, we've got to get in front of the FDA. We've got to get in front of these governmental entities. Something's got to be done at the front end before these things are approved.
So I guess I'll try to paraphrase this, and for those of us out here who are wondering. Now, when you say the farmer flies on, do they fly on the herbicide with airplanes? Do they use big tractors or what have you, right?
Well, you could have either. Can be an airplane application, but the problems that we typically deal with are simply spray boom applications.
Okay.
And when you have drift, you'll have a tractor going down with a spray boom. Maybe the corn is 30 inches high, the boom's another foot above, it's rocking, the wind's blowing toward the tomato crop, and it carries that drift.
Right.
When you have volatilization, you may apply it without a drift, but the conditions are such that it kind of sits in a cloud and it can volatilize or kind of lift, and I'm oversimplifying, but almost like a cloud and move, and then come down. So you might be 2 or 3 fields or miles away when you land. And so trying to say, who applied this and caused this to volatilize and land on my orchard or land on my tomato field, and to then have some opportunity to say, you know, you need to make compensation, because most of the laws say when you apply a pesticide, you have strict liability. You can, if you are off target, you will be cited for a violation. Now, whether or not the laws of compensation are strict liability might vary from state by state. You may have to show negligence as opposed to an ultra hazardous or a trespass. But, you know, simplifying the problem is this lifts, moves, and comes down, and showing who caused the problem is really the a huge issue. And then controlling it, you know, controlling the conditions of application so that it doesn't volatilize.
So it's almost you have to have the perfect conditions.
Well, I would defer to Steve Smith or to others on mm-hmm. on 2,4-D and dicamba and conditions on which they've been applied. I've worked much more with Roundup. But understanding the issue of volatilization as an attorney who's charged with, you know, being able to show what caused the problem. I mean, you're not going to get compensated unless you or made whole for the problem unless you can show who caused the problem. And volatilization just makes that so difficult. You know, it's already difficult neighbor on neighbor, these farmers who have known each other, tons of insurance claim they will, your insurance company will claim that it's a pollution exclusion and you only have limited coverage. And so you have farmers who are vulnerable to lose their personal assets when they have drift or volatilization. You have farmers in a position where they now have to make claims against the neighboring farmer. It's really a difficult issue for the courts and the community. Volatilization just multiplies the problem, particularly for the injured party.
Well, I know we're going to lose you here because you have to go to a wedding, but let me ask you, you know, what I think the question of the day is, do you think as an attorney who has to litigate these problems that agriculture science is kind of outsmarting itself by creating super weeds and super problems?
Well, it's probably no different than any change or any scientific advance in any field. When you have some advance, you have consequences to the advance. So Roundup was a wonderful thing for production for you know, grain farmers.
Right.
And it had some risks, and now we have some problems with, you know, Roundup-resistant weeds. I don't think that's surprising. It's probably just a function of evolution. So I don't know that they're outsmarting themselves. I think it's a natural evolution. The problem is, are we at the point where this next change is understood enough and controllable enough that, you know, people aren't going to be harmed in a way that they can't be, you know, made whole? Is, you know, we can't have just reckless application without consequence for if there's drift.
Well, what do you think the answer to that question is?
Well, I think Steve Smith's probably the better person to address that because he has worked with the committee
okay.
and with the governmental agencies in terms of saying these are things that need to be looked at as a class in advance. And I think that Dow has done things in terms of their own formula versus, you know, generalized 2,4-D and will people use the cheaper version of 2,4-D versus the Dow issue. And those are really specific, more scientific you know, agricultural
right.
issues that are better addressed by those experts than me as a lawyer who, you know, comes in after the fact and deals with the, you know, trying to resolve the problems they might
Well, do you think you'll be able to resolve these problems? I mean, or are they going to become a super problem for you?
Well, definitely, if volatile is, if we switch all the Roundup corn we have right now to 2,4-D corn and there is volatilization, there's no question it will be a problem for people who suffer the result of the volatilization.
Because they won't know who to blame.
Correct.
So it will be like a ghost that rises from one field and floats on the wind to someplace down the line and then plunks itself down and wipes out somebody's crops, and the farmer will wake up one morning and the leaves will be wilted and they'll call up Attorney Gene Seeler. And Gene Sealer will say what?
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us, Gene.
Okay, thank you. It was nice talking to you.
All right. Well, Steve Smith, let's go to you. Wow. Does that sound like she hit it pretty much on the head?
Well, she hit a home run with every description she gave.
Let me back up then. Do you know of any farmers who do not just love this technology? I mean, I just think of the wonderful, all the time I spent in the field weeding, and I think, gosh, it would have been wonderful to have a magic potion that you fly on and all of your problems are gone.
Well, certainly when you say, do you know any farmers that aren't in love with, there are farm groups and ideas of
organic agriculture.
People, organic agriculture that, you know, do not adhere to some of the new technology. So, I'd have to say, yeah, there are farmers that have not participated in that. But the conventional corn and bean farmers, of which I am one, my wife and I own a small acreage, and we do that. And there is really nothing more satisfying than driving by your field and seeing it 100% weed-free. And I can tell you that some of this technology made an awfully good farmer out of me.
And a lot of people, right? If you just drive through the heartland of the country, and the precision you see is just absolutely amazing. When we come back, we're going to talk about the flip side of that technology, which is the super weeds, the super problems, with Super Steve Smith, the Save Our Crops. And we're going to talk about what happens to tomato crops and where we go from here. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. If you'd like to participate today, you certainly may. Pick up your phones. We're at 831-479-1080. That's 479-1080. I am Michael Olson. We have Steve Smith with us and you. Do stay tuned. We will be right back after these very important messages. Hey, we're back. Michael Olson here. This is the Food Chain Radio Programs. Folks, you know, so much Monsanto herbicide was applied to so many Monsanto genetically engineered crops, weeds became resistant. They're called super weeds, and they're popping up all over the world. I just read a piece about the farmers in Australia fighting these super weeds. They call them super weeds because you can dump Roundup on them, and the weeds just smile. Can't hurt me with that stuff. And so what do we do about these super weeds? Well, we invent something else, another crop that will withstand 2,4-D. Now, this 2,4-D was a major constituent of Agent Orange, the herbicide that was made popular in the Vietnam War. And so people are going, oh, my God, we've got Agent Orange corn. And so today you're just kind of pausing to ask, you know, is agriculture science developing these super weeds and super problems? Are we actually outsmarting ourselves here? We're talking with Steve Smith, who's a food processor from the Midwest. And Steve's faced with a problem of drift because this this old herbicide, 2,4-D, has a propensity for volatilizing itself into a cloud and floating along on the wind and then dropping onto another crop. Have you seen this actually happen, Steve?
Yes, we've had instances where this has certainly been documented. It hasn't happened to us very much because, for the most part, producers in the Midwest have recognized for many decades the likelihood of this stuff moving places where it's not supposed to be, and really just don't use it much in the main production areas or around sensitive crops because they've had some bad experiences one point in time with a neighbor or a homeowner or something where it did move, and people learn pretty quickly about things like that.
But
it's not been used a lot.
Yeah, it's not been used a lot, but here we are coming up with a situation where the Roundup Ready cropping system is no longer working because the weeds are developing resistance, so we're looking to the 2,4-D system. And what will happen then if 2,4-D is applied as almost universally as the glyphosate? And so that's a whole different situation, is it not?
It is. You know, it's interesting, though, that weeds were becoming unaffected by herbicides all the way back in from the 1960s on. And so it's not just necessarily a particular technology. Weeds are pretty smart. And when
that's why they call them weeds.
Yeah. And when producers use only one mechanism or a very narrow band of mechanisms for controlling them, it doesn't take them too long to figure that out. And so it's nothing new and particularly associated only with GMO crops, but with the just the overwhelming use of glyphosate in the last 15 years, the problem is certainly growing, and it's growing very quickly. I think now we have like 22 different weed species that are resistant to glyphosate.
So how long has glyphosate and Roundup Ready cropping system, how long has that been on the market?
It started in soybeans in, I believe it was 1996, and was widely adopted in 97, and by 2000, the percentage of the crop was just huge. Roundup corn came out a couple years later, and again, by the early 2000s, the adoption has been just a major percentage of the corn crop. And so then you have the same chemistry being used on both soybean acres and corn acres, which has really allowed this problem to get out of hand. If we would have been better in stewarding this product, we would have figured out that we needed to use different forms of modes of action between the soybeans and corn, and that would have helped stave off some of the problems that we're seeing today. But we're here, and this is now we got to deal with that.
Well, it's I think important to understand why we're here. And essentially what you're saying is that year after year, in field after field, we did the same thing, which was applied glyphosate herbicide. And in doing so, we killed all of those weeds that were vulnerable to glyphosate.
That's correct. And eventually you find a weed that doesn't die, and then that weed propagates, and the seeds that it passes on through its DNA is now going to be resistant to the glyphosate.
And of course, it's probably having a great time because most of its competition are gone.
That's exactly right too, and so it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, really.
In what respect?
Well, that just as you said, that you know, its competition with other weeds is not there, and so it's got pretty much a wide open canopy to go and really enjoy life.
Okay, and they are evidently, from what I've heard, it's becoming a fairly significant problem around the world. Have you ever come to grips with the notion of whether these crops are good to eat or not? Just as a sideline here.
The Save Our Crops Coalition has purposely narrowed its focus just to about off-target movement. There are a lot of brilliant scientists and regulators that we're trusting to do their job about whether this is the right thing or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we've... there's room for disagreement in all of those things, but what we've yet to find is that nobody has disagreed about the need to prevent off-target movement. And so that makes for a good issue for us.
And one heck of a one to focus on. So let's focus on that. Let's volatilization. How on earth do you stop something that turns itself into a cloud and sneaks off in the middle of the day?
Well, you don't by any application methods. You can watch, you know, future weather or some things like that and maybe have a little bit better shot. And so the only method of stopping volatilization is to have a formula that in lab terms would have a lower vapor pressure. In other words, it's not nearly as prone to leaving its state of liquid and moving into a gaseous form. And so that's the basic problem with volatilization. And the traditional formulations of 2,4-D and dicamba are known to be highly susceptible to volatilization.
So Dow was inventing a high price spread, so to speak?
Dow has worked very hard. This situation is so well known that Dow has invested millions of dollars to come up with a formulation that is less volatile. And so we applaud that effort because that's certainly going to be a very important component on what's going on. And so their product is the lab tests show and the field results that we've seen show that it is less volatile. And so you may wonder if that's the case, why do we even still have an issue? And so the problem still remains that there are other formulations that are still on the market. And it's much like the old adage about a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. If the other formulations are still available, if the other formulations are
and who's going to buy the expensive spread when the cheap spread works just as well? If folks are going to take a quick break, right back on the food chain, do stay tuned. Well, folks, up the road here a few miles, farmer sprayed his crops for one thing, and the spray drifted the next day onto the neighbor's farm and killed the whole crop. And so that farmer sued his neighbor for $1 million and won. Had to pay. Gosh, that was make for a real tough neighborhood to live in. Steve Smith, you see that?
Yeah, except that more times than not, the pay part that you mentioned is not happening in adequate or even close to adequate forms.
So the spray happens, the crop dies, and the lawsuit happens, and the money doesn't come.
Yeah, one of our members of Save Our Crop is a landscape farmer from Kentucky who his whole farm took a hit of 2,4-D volatilization from a neighbor, and in this case they actually did know where it came from, and the loss was in excess of $1 million, and certainly attorney fees and going to trial was made that easy.
Add another million.
Well, at least a lot higher.
Yeah.
And when it was all said and done, he did not end up receiving any help because when the jury took the case, even though there was no question of what caused the damage, how much the damage was, where it came from, there was no question in any of the science in this. The jury took a look at the neighbor and said, gosh, from the label language that was on there, we can't find where he did anything negligent. And essentially, it's a situation that if you directly drift on somebody, you have violated the label language somewhere along the way. But a volatilization, where it picks up and moves later, in most cases, the applicator has done nothing wrong. It's just the environmental conditions that later on change, and the label only covers the application. And so in this regard, this fellow did not get any compensation, and it's he's struggling just to stay in business. And so it's the pay part that we're finding is not working very well. And that's not the only thing. Certainly people don't want to lose their customers because they don't have anything to sell for the long term.
Right.
Organic farms don't want to lose their certification for 3 years, which can happen. And so the problems are not just only that current year. It can go on for quite some time.
So these are really big stink bombs, aren't they?
Well, it might be a different way of saying that, but certainly the odor that comes from following a loss, if you're the guy that has taken the hit, is going to hang with you for quite some time.
And I'm just thinking about the neighborhood. You know, if this happens to you, and you know it's coming from the neighbor down the way, or maybe not, maybe it's from the other neighbor, and you don't know which neighbor. I mean, this must cause, you know, all kinds of real interesting dynamics in the neighborhood.
Well, you know, it's been that way so far with our direct drift cases where we absolutely know where things come from. But this situation of maybe not even knowing where it comes from just makes that all the more worse. One of the weed professors at Ohio State had a really good comment about this, and he said that there's a price to be paid for developing Roundup-resistant weeds, and unfortunately that price is going to be paid by people who least benefit from the technology.
And that's the neighbor down the way.
That's the neighbor down the way, who loses through no fault of his own, either his crop or the ability to sell to expecting consumers.
Yeah, in the case of organic farmers. Steve Smith, is there an alternative? I mean, I just think of how wonderful this technology is for farmers, because essentially it takes a lot of labor out of the business of growing crops.
Oh, it's certainly, again, it's been a wonderful help for commercial farmers, and I don't think anybody from that realm would ever disagree with that. Solutions, you know, as a coalition, our aim has just been to try to point out that the two particular chemistries that we're concerned about, 2,4-D and dicamba, everybody in the world knows that these things move, and that the people that's doing the technology releases should have taken another look at which chemicals that they wanted to combine with the Roundup-resistant genes. And in this case, we think they've bet on the wrong two.
Which are those that have the propensity to volatilize.
That's right. There are many chemistries that do not volatilize, and some of those are going to be coming on the market just a year or two down the road, and we don't have any problem with technology itself, but we do have when we're confident that there will be injuries that will be occurring to people and crops.
One grower called it the blob that ate Tokyo.
Well, that was actually a phrase that I've used because
that was you, huh?
That was me. People sometimes don't always understand the volatilization and what it does, but almost everybody has seen some of the old horror movies that where things just kind of creep down the street and get you. So that was a term that I've used. It's not very scientific, but it sort of gets the point across.
It sort of does. So we're going to take a quick break, the last break, and when we come back, we have a few minutes. But I want to talk with Steve Smith about the big question, which is agriculture science outsmarting itself by creating super weeds and super problems? What do you think? We will be right back after these important messages, so please do stay tuned. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Today we're talking resistance with Steve Smith of Save Our Crops, and you right back. Do stay tuned. Well, folks, Steve Smith calls it a blob. It's the 2,4-D pesticide that is applied to field to kill weeds, and then it volatilizes and lifts itself up in the middle of night, maybe, and creeps across the landscape and lands on another farmer and destroys his or her crops. What to do, what to do. Steve, is there really any alternative to this cropping system at all that you can think of, other than putting people like me back into the fields where we hoe the weeds?
Well, we're certainly hopeful that if the technology does continue on and they get their approvals, that there will be at least major efforts to make sure that the products used are the ones that are less volatile.
So essentially what you're talking about is forcing people to buy the high price spread by taking the rest of it off the market.
That's exactly right. And, you know, nobody ever said that controlling weeds had to be cheap or had to be easy. It's going to involve growers and universities all teaching better methods of stewardship, and it's going to involve better formulations that fix some of the problems that otherwise are going to come about.
How much more would it cost to have people do the job?
Oh, from a from a hand weeding and hand hoeing standpoint, there's no cost you can put on it. Number one, there just would never be enough people available to do it, or to do it adequately, as it's getting done right now. That ship sailed 75 years ago.
Then how do the organic people do it?
Well, they're doing it on just so minimal amount of acres.
Okay. So what you're saying is that growing on the scale that we do, it would be impossible to do it any other way.
Absolutely impossible on the scale of modern agriculture. You know, we're looking at potentially 180 million acres of corn and soybeans in this country, and to do that the old-fashioned way, it's going to involve more tillage, which causes more erosion and problems in that regard too. So
how many acres
did you
say?
We're trying to find a good balance.
How many acres?
The USDA would show that there's going to be about 180 million acres of corn and soybeans in the coming year, 170.
Okay, Steve Smith, tomato processor. What happens when there's 180 million acres worth of 2,4-D applied and volatilized on that much land, and it rises up, and tomato grower Steve Smith's going, what are you going to do? I mean, if this 2,4-D technology comes into play and Roundup goes away and all of the farmers are using this 2,4-D and it rises up and volatilizes and goes charging across the land, holy smokes.
That's exactly right. And so you all get together and you form a coalition to try to make the changes that it takes to do it. You have... In a brief moment, capsulize what our coalition's all about.
Okay. Well, I guess I've done my job now. Steve Smith, thank you so much for joining us on The Food Chain today. Thank you all out there for joining us. Tune in next week for more What's Eating What Radio. We're going to go to Amish country and find out why the Amish farm kids have no allergies. And, well, you can join us on the forums at metrofarm.com. Always remember now, cheap food isn't. Thank you so much, Steve.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.